Good morning. The House Judiciary Committee will call to order. Ask our members to please take their seats. Quorum is present. We'll ask the clerk to take the roll.
I'll make a summary.
Representative Shemansky.
Present.
Representative Mazerall.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Champion.
Here.
Representative Cornish. Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Kreisel.
Here.
Representative Lane. Representative Lesh. Representative Liebling. Representative Shoemaker.
Here.
Representative Smith. Representative Swazinski. Representative Vogel.
Present.
Representative Wardlow.
Present. Okay. Approval of the minutes from the previous meeting. Would someone like to move the minutes from the previous meeting?
So moved.
Representative Vogel moves the minutes from the previous meeting. Is there any discussion? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say nay. Minutes are approved. First bill on our agenda today is House File 1872, the maximum fees for notary publics. We have Representative Runbeck with us this morning. Welcome, Representative Runbeck. Please present your bill. First, we need to move your bill. Representative Shoemaker, would you like to move the bill?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Shoemaker moves House File 1872, recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Proceed, Ms. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1872 is sort of under the general broad category of getting government out of price setting and price controls and getting the market to work, so allowing the market to work. And we're talking about the area of notaries public, and actually the law has set the price for a notary public service at a dollar, and that has not been changed since 1983. And a gentleman from the Secretary of State's office even thinks that the number goes back even further than that. So just inflation alone would suggest that, you know, it's very out of date. But we're looking to repeal the law. Because, I mean, this is a commodity. I mean, you can find another provider down the road, and the market will work extremely well in this situation. So, and these days, you've got a lot of sort of quasi-governmental businesses being done through companies like PostNet, mailboxes, etc., and the UPS store. And they all are providing notaries public services these days. And the bill, I just want to thank Randy Jessup, who brought the bill to me. He runs a UPS store, and he could probably tell you, too, in terms of sort of the cost of doing business, how you get to be a notary public and why they need the opportunity to really recoup costs and so on. So I'll let Randy maybe just explain briefly importance of the bill.
Well, good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Randy Jessup. I own two UPS stores, one in Roseville by Rosedale Mall and the other in St. Paul by Highland Park. Myself, along with several others in our industry, as Linda mentioned, do offer notary service. And we have a statute in the state of Minnesota that we can only charge at our locations up to a dollar. And that is probably one of the best bargains, I would say, out there today for consumers, especially when you speak with consumers that come from other states. They will say, wow, it's only a dollar? That's terrible. You should be paid more than that. Because I come from California, and we always get charged $10. One of the things that I did when I put this together was take a look at what has happened here in the state in regards to notary publics. And we did go ahead and talk to the Secretary of State about 3 years ago. I think it was 3 years ago. There's about 100,000 notaries in the state. Today there's about 85,000. It has gone down by 15%. And one of the issues that I think that has caused that is that the cost of notary has gone up. The registration fee with the Secretary of State used to be $40. It's now $120. Okay, so it's jumped dramatically. You also have to register with the county that you are doing notary in. So here in Ramsey County, that's an additional $20. I think in Hennepin County as well, it's $20. Okay. As we've looked at it, there are a number of owners in the UPS store system that have decided, you know what, because of the increased cost and also the concern for liability, we're just not going to offer it any longer. So we have in our, I want to say, 60 stores, UPS stores in the state of Minnesota, I think there's about now 10 that no longer offer notary. Okay? But yet, there is a demand out there by consumers that need notary service. In addition, you've got banks that are starting to reduce their notary exposure as well. Now, they're not going to charge for customers that are theirs in the bank, but we have noticed in the last 3 years, I want to say probably the last 2 years, that there's a Wells Fargo by our store in Rosedale, and they no longer will do notary service unless you have a checking account, savings account, or some investment with the bank. So there's becoming less and less opportunity as well for the public in general to find notary service. I think this is a situation where it would be best to go ahead and simply repeal this law. Probably at one time in history there was a reason for why a statute was put in place, and there was a statute put in place predominantly, I think, all across the country. Today, Iowa does not have any statute on its books in regards to what can be a maximum charge for a notary. I did talk with one UPS store owner down in Iowa, and I think in general they charge, you know, anywhere in the range of $3 to $7. It's not like it's gone outlandish and everyone is charging $100, because you can go somewhere else and get that service accomplished. The other states as well around us, just from a cost standpoint, I think what we've got is we've got filing fees anywhere from $10 up to $36. So we in the state of Minnesota, we charge well for that privilege to go forward. Any event, we have kind of talked through this. Linda has gratefully gone ahead and sponsored this legislation. I'm open to any questions if you have anything.
Are there any questions among the committee members? Seeing none, Representative Runbeck, would you like to give us a summary of your bill, and we'll be ready to take a vote on it.
Well, I think we've all kind of gotten used to the idea that there's things that the market can do better, and I think this is clearly one situation. So I appreciate the chance, and I thank Representative Hillstrom and Hansen for jumping on the bill as well. So it has bipartisan support, and the Secretary of State's office is also in support.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. I did want to comment that and congratulate you. We're not adding any new language to statute. We're just doing a repealer. So, all right. With that, we will vote on Representative Schumacher. Will. Oh, pardon me. Is there any discussion or any other witnesses on this that want to testify for or against House File 1872?
Sure, I do have a couple of other, you know, UPS, PostNet people, but they're just here to support us.
All right. Well, thank you for your attending with our committee this morning. All right. Representative Schumacher, would you like to renew your motion that House File 1872 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The bill is passed.
Thank you,
Representative Runbeck. All right, next on our agenda, we're going to deviate slightly from our agenda and bring up Representative Gottwald on House File 1945, and we will then take House File 1938 following this bill. Good morning, Representative Gottwald. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Chair Szymanski. That's kind of fun to say.
All right. Do I have a motion to bring the bill before the committee? Representative Grunhagen?
So moved.
Representative Grunhagen moves that House File 1945 be presented before the committee with a recommendation to pass and to be sent on to the Public Safety Committee. Is that your wish, Representative Gottwald?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a really exciting opportunity to bring this bill before the state legislature, starting with this committee. We worked very hard to arrive at agreement on this language to create a felony neglect penalty in state statute for neglect of vulnerable adults. This is something that's been long overdue. Many of us have heard the horrendous stories about abuse of vulnerable adults and the fact that they can only be charged with a gross misdemeanor. This now creates a new felony level charge for neglect, intentional neglect of vulnerable adults. We had to work extremely hard with the provider community and the prosecutors, as well as the unions and many others. There's just so many people who came together around this to make sure that we weren't doing unintended consequences and hurting people who are trying to care for people in difficult situations, maybe are causing injury through accident. And I have a whole list of people I want to thank about this, but we've arrived at a very good solution. I think that this language is going to end up being a model for the nation. I want to thank Representative Hillstrom for signing on to the bill and supporting this process. And I'm optimistic, Mr. Chair, as we go forward, that we'll have additional bipartisan support on this bill. We know that I'm going to run through the list of people here. We'll have some testimony from some of the people involved in bringing this bill together. And then Commissioner Jessen, Cindy Jessen, is also here from the Department of Human Services to kind of speak on behalf of the Dayton administration. I want to thank Michael Freeman, the Hennepin County Attorney, David Brown, who's the senior attorney with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, Amy Sweezy, another senior attorney with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, Iris Freeman, who's Associate Director of the Center for Elder Justice and Policy at William Mitchell College of Law, Kevin Goodnow, working with the Minnesota Home Care Association, Carrie Thurlow and Toby Pearson with the Long-Term Care Imperative, Mary Jo George with AARP, Rick Varco with SEIU Union, Matt Anderson with the Minnesota Hospital Association, and Mary Krenke. Cindy Jessen is here, as I mentioned. Jeannie Wood from the Department of Human Services was very helpful in this process. Shannon Cunningham from the Minnesota Nurses Association, and my own committee administrator, Holly Iverson, extremely helpful. So you can see we brought a broad variety of people together in some very tough discussions about the language around this, and we think, again, we have model language for the rest of the nation on this. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll ask one of my testifiers, which one's first?
Representative Gottwalt, you have an amendment to your bill?
I'm sorry, yes, I should move the DE2 amendment so we have the language that we negotiated before the committee.
I will ask Representative Gruenhagen to move the DE4 amendment, DE2 amendment. Okay. All right, Representative Gottwalt, to the DE2 amendment. Oh, pardon me.
Is there any
discussion on the amendment? All right. All in favor of acceptance of the DE2 amendment? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say nay. The amendment is before us, Representative Gottwalt.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, I'd like to introduce Mike Freeman with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office to make some comments on the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Mr. Freeman. Please introduce yourself for the table.
Members of the committee, I'm Mike Freeman, the duly elected Hennepin County Attorney, and thank you for welcoming me back to the Minnesota Legislature. It's been a few years, but it's good to see good citizens working hard trying to do the people's business. So thank you for the service that you do. And I want a special appreciation to Representative Gottwald. When you try to make a change in this area of the law, you have to have the patience of Job. And the good representative has done that. It's not easy. Some changes needed to be made. There's some strong feelings in this. And in the art of true compromise, we have something presented to you today that is supported by all the major players. House File 1945, and as the author's amendment presented to you, does something important for the issue of intentional neglect of vulnerable adults. I emphasize intentional, because what we're trying to address here is not casual or mistakes. We're trying to address here the intentional ignoring, abuse, or neglect of vulnerable adults, the folks that probably next to our children we most should be most concerned about in society, because frankly they really can't help themselves. Current penalties today are just inadequate. Gross misdemeanor is the most serious penalty, and that, Mr. Chairman and members, does not mean any jail time and means a slap on the face. It's similar to, it's an inadequate penalty, let me say that, particularly for situations in where we see the intentional neglect results in amputation, when we find maggots, infested ulcers, when we see people left to rot in their own waste for weeks at a time. And Senior Hennepin County Attorney Amy Sweezy, who's prosecuted some of these cases, will be giving you perhaps too graphic detail of those cases. Mr. Chairman and members, we protect animals better than our vulnerable adults. It's a 2-year felony for cruelty to animals. It's a 5-year felony for neglect of children. And I believe that this has been an oversight, but frankly, it's been something we've been working on for a number of years. And your champions of this cause has done what good legislators do when there are strong feelings on all sides: go back and work it out. Well, frankly, we finally came in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and with help of Iris Freeman, who's been a longtime champion here, and said, we need to move forward. And so we presented a bill, and there was a good deal of opposition and strong feelings, and Representative Gottwall did what you should do as a good chairman and brought us together. This compromise, after a considerable process, responded to the questions of perhaps the felony was too broad. It responded to the legitimate concerns of unions that some of their members might be drawn into it inappropriately. It responded to some of the care providers and institutions who felt they may be held responsible for actions of individual persons who work for them without their knowledge. But basically, we have now presented a program which will make sense. It will make actions, intentional neglect, which results in substantial bodily harm, into a 5-year felony penalty. It will mean those actions of intentional neglect which result in great bodily harm into a 10-year felony. And to bring this into common English, substantial bodily harm means bodily injury, temporary but substantial disfigurement, temporary or substantial loss or impairment of function of a body, a broken bone, stitches, serious bruising in our practice. Great bodily harm is bodily injury which creates a high probability of death, serious or permanent disfigurement, the most serious of physical crimes, short of death. So, Mr. Chairman and Representative Gottwald, thank you for your hard work on this. We think we have a package for which this committee and the legislature could be proud. And I would, I would like to, if I may, turn this over to Senior Attorney Amy Sweezy, who 4 years ago I promoted to the position of Senior Attorney specifically to work on vulnerable adult issues. These are issues that, frankly, have been neglected, not intentionally, but they've been neglected by the law enforcement community. They're hard cases. They're difficult cases. Amy's done a great job, and she's really the inspiration, including Iris Freeman, behind this. May I do that?
Absolutely.
Good morning, Ms. Sweezy. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Amy Sweezy, S-W-E-A-S-Y. I am an assistant, or a senior assistant Hennepin County attorney. If I might, before I started my career there, I just wanted to share that I was a page for the House more years ago than I care to admit, but had the opportunity to work as a page in this very room many, many years ago, so it's fun to be back this way. So thanks for the opportunity. What we did to walk you through what's exactly contained in the new House File 1945, what we did was, first of all, to take the felony crime completely out and define it separately from the gross misdemeanor crime. And it was there that we decided to title it intentional deprivation versus neglect. We believe that more accurately reflects the conduct for the crime with the serious penalties. To intentionally deprive, the caregiver must do that of necessary food, clothing, shelter, health care, or supervision when the caregiver or operator is reasonably able to make the necessary provisions. That language about being reasonably necessary to make or reasonably able to make the necessary provisions comes from the child neglect statute. So that's where we got that, from another statute that works. So the crime would be to deprive if you were able to provide the care in the first place. We added two different theories under which to prosecute the felony neglect. The first is that the conduct occurs where the caregiver knows or has reason to know that the deprivation could likely result in substantial bodily harm or great bodily harm. So we've added a mental, a level of intent or a mindset, as we call it in the criminal law, that doesn't exist in the gross misdemeanor. So a prosecutor prosecuting under this part of the felony deprivation law would have to show that the caregiver knew or had reason to know that the harm that occurred could have taken place. So that's a new element to this crime. The other theory under which the felony can be prosecuted is that the deprivation occurred over an extended period of time. And that's meant to get at the kind of cases that County Attorney Freeman spoke about, where the deprivation goes on for a long period of time, where people are found in basements having not had medical care for weeks, months, years, depending on what the condition is. So to gather those very, very serious cases that, frankly, often result in the most horrific degrees of harm. So there are two theories under which a prosecution could proceed, and I suppose in theory you could have both and prosecute that way. The exemptions that are in Subdivision 2 exist now for the gross misdemeanor law, and we have left those intact. Those are situations to which the law simply won't apply. And just to boil them down, the three of them apply to medical decisions, medical directors, or medical directives, and existing consensual relationships. We have done nothing to change those there. The penalty sections are a maximum of 10 years for causing great bodily harm and 5 years for causing substantial bodily harm, and those are in line with other statutes in the criminal code where substantial bodily harm and great bodily harm are differentiating factors. So those are, for lack of a better term, kind of ordinary classifications. Probably, in my opinion, the most significant and most interesting part of what we've done here and what we worked very hard on in the negotiations was to create affirmative defenses. Everyone was in agreement that there are certain classes of events that could take place that we didn't feel fell into the realm of something criminal. And what we have are three of them. The first is to protect the worker on the line, so to speak. The nursing home, nursing assistant, the nurse, the person who is providing the actual hands-on care, probably in a facility. I can imagine other situations, but what we were really looking at was in the facilities. And the affirmative defense that will apply to those employees will be that they can bring in evidence that they were unable to make the necessary provisions to provide the care that they needed to do due to inadequate staffing, inadequate supervision, or institutional policies. In other words, if the worker is unable to provide the care because of something else going on in that facility, then they can present evidence, and if they prove that by a preponderance of the evidence, and the state cannot disprove that, the prosecution, whatever stage it's at, would be concluded. That's evidence, obviously, that could be presented before a charge is filed, after a charge is filed. And what's different about an affirmative defense versus an exemption is that that is something that can be argued to a jury. And we would, if the law passes the way it is, there'll have to be jury instructions created for these three affirmative defenses. So in that way, we think it's better than an exemption. It provides an opportunity to present that evidence at every stage of a criminal prosecution. The second is for the operators, so the managers, the supervisors, the people in charge, not your hands-on day-to-day caregiver. And an affirmative defense would apply to them that would allow them to present evidence that they neither knowingly, intentionally, or recklessly permitted acts by an employee. And that's meant to protect providers who have no idea that a particular employee has decided to go off on his or her own outside the policies of the of their training or the facility and inflict this kind of harm. So that we want to make sure that we're prosecuting the perpetrator, not other parties. And then finally, the third affirmative defense was the, I think, the last thing that we agreed on when we last met on Tuesday. And that was meant to cover the situation in the facility where a worker, and it could happen outside a facility too, but where a worker has to make a decision that when they're being asked to do two things at once. And the hypothetical we've been talking about for a very long time now is where two call lights go on at once. There's only one of you, and you have to make a decision. And by making a decision, a good one, something accidental and unfortunate could happen to the other person. And we don't mean to criminalize the conduct of somebody who has two bad choices to make and for whatever reason chose the wrong one. So the third affirmative defense would allow a person under consideration for charges or being prosecuted to provide evidence that they were unable to attend to the situation that resulted in the substantial or great bodily harm because they were reasonably and necessarily providing care to someone else who needed it. And we think that I'm delighted that we got agreement on how to address that particular troublesome situation because that had eluded us for some time. So those are the differences between the felony bill as we have it now and the gross misdemeanor that exists. The affirmative defenses, all three of them, will apply also to the gross misdemeanor crime with this amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Sweezy. Representative Liebling has a question. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And first of all, thank you for this bill. I think, you know, I'm totally on board with the need for the bill and what you're trying to do. But I have some questions about the way you're doing it. And I also commend you for this DE amendment, which I think is a tremendous improvement over the original bill, because I had some real concerns about that, and I guess everybody else did too. So I'm glad we're moving in the right direction. The concern that I have, though, relates to these affirmative defenses. And again, I commend you for trying to use these to meet the needs of a lot of different people. But I think they might need more work. And the reason I say that is because I'm sure that you know as a prosecutor, when you have an affirmative defense, you're putting the burden on the defendant to come forward with something. And there's a tricky area there, and I have to say I haven't had a, you know, chance to really study this. I'm doing this kind of on the fly. But, you know, constitutionally, of course, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt every element of the defense, of every element of the offense, sorry. And when you put the burden then on the defendant to come forward with something and prove it by a preponderance, you may, in fact, be requiring the defendant to prove that the defendant is not guilty, which is unconstitutional. So I just want to make sure that we're doing this properly so that we don't run into that situation. And in my career, I have run into that situation, and I've seen statutes invalidated for that very thing, which is why I'm raising it here. So if we're going through and we're, you know, initially in the bill, under the felony deprivation, there's an intentionally, the state has to prove intentional deprivation, which is fine. But then when you get to the affirmative defenses, you're requiring the defendant to prove by a preponderance of the evidence something that at least when I go down to the second one, you're requiring the person to show that they did not knowingly, intentionally, or recklessly permit. So in my view, you're shifting to the defendant there. If you, the state, has to prove intentionally, then for the person to come in and show that they didn't permit these acts, they have to prove it now, basically negate your element of proof by a preponderance of the evidence. That's troubling to me. Another one that's a little different issue that I have is your number three affirmative defense, which you know, this idea that just because the call light went on in another room and they had to be there instead of with this person, you know, I get that. That's a great idea. The problem is that in your initial elements, you've got this extended period of time thing. So I'm just wondering how that works. You initially have to prove that they did this over an extended period of time, which is a little vague to begin with, I have to say. Actually, I'm asking you a lot of questions all at once. Maybe you want to respond first to the thing about the affirmative defense number two and the shifting of the burden, and then maybe I can talk about the rest.
Okay, Ms. Sweezy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the affirmative defenses are modeled very generally from the other affirmative defenses in the criminal code. All of which state that they have to be proven by a preponderance of the evidence. Now, these are, of course, very fact-specific to this law. Yes, it remains the case that the state has to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt, the intentional deprivation, the knew or had reason to know, or an extended period of time. Those are ors, so not everyone will have been over an extended period of time necessarily. So, yes. We don't believe and spent significant time in our group discussing it is not meant to shift a burden of proof, and it does not shift a burden of proof. Whether the affirmative defense is alleged at any state, the state still has to prove the intentional deprivation, either that they knew or had reason to know, or there was an extended period of time that the level of harm resulted. The affirmative defense is meant to provide a vehicle in the statute for persons either pre-charging or criminal defendants to come forward with evidence that would, it doesn't shift the burden of proof. If it's available to a defendant and they have that sort of evidence and they can prove that by a preponderance, which is the standard in the other criminal in the other affirmative defenses in the criminal code, if they can do that, then, once that evidence comes forward, it's a burden of production of evidence, not of a shift in the burden of proof in any way. If that evidence exists with the burden of production, we then go back, this is sort of prosecution 101, but we go back to the government, who must disprove the affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt. So the burden of proof for the prosecutor is going to be beyond a reasonable doubt, whether it is to prove all of the elements, which is going to be necessary whether or not an affirmative defense is asserted, and then to disprove an affirmative defense that has been offered by a preponderance of the evidence by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I know that's convoluted, but that's how it works.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, thank you for that explanation. You know, I'm with you as far as how the burdens shift and all that, but I don't think that's what this is saying. This is saying that the defendant has to prove by a preponderance of the evidence. I think it would be proper to say that they have the burden of production to come forward with such evidence, and then the state has the burden to disprove it beyond reasonable doubt. And I know that sometimes this is not entirely clear in other statutes where you've got an affirmative defense, and this is an area of law that gets really confusing. But I think in a trial situation, it's really important, obviously, what the language is. Mm-hmm. And so I just would ask you to think really carefully. I know you all have. I don't want to say it that way, but I guess I'd like you to rethink this issue, because it really troubles me that you're asking defendants to prove something by a preponderance in this situation rather than just come forward. So I think what you just said is contrary to what it says here in the language, and I'd be happy with what you just said.
All right. Ms. Sweezy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. It's the only way I can respond to that is that it's simply the way all the affirmative defenses are written in the criminal code, as well as those that are not written into the criminal code. Self-defense, alibi, none of these things are written into the criminal code, but it is the practice and the knowledge of the bench and the criminal bar that these are how affirmative defenses work. So I guess, you know, on one level I can suggest at least this one is written into the law. Most of them are not. But I'm not, and as I said, we tried to look at other affirmative defenses. I'm not aware of another example that would spell it out exactly like that in the criminal code.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if maybe this could solve the problem for Representative Liebling. We amend the DE2 amendment by deleting lines 2.24 through 2.36, since the burden of proof on the prosecution is clear about having to prove intent, and it would remove any question about the defendant having to come up with any other affirmative defenses. And it appears the testifier has stated that, this is the way it's understood in the rest of the law, so maybe the judge would understand that. And the judge writes the jury instructions anyway. It isn't the legislature that writes them pro forma, so it is drawn from statute. But I wonder if we just took away the defendant's opportunity to get any affirmative defenses, would that solve your concern, Representative Liebling?
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I'm not asking to get rid of the affirmative defenses. I just don't want the defendant to have to prove them, and as opposed to taking away the prosecutor's responsibility to do that. And I see where you're going with that. I think that a lot of people have done a lot of work on this to assure themselves that the wrong people aren't going to be prosecuted, so I'm certainly not looking to do that. But I just want to rethink this a little bit, and I don't know how fast a track this is on, Representative Gottwald, but I think it would be really good to, you know, having worked it through so well and so far, to give it another work through just to make sure that all of this makes sense in the way it would work in a trial situation.
Representative Liebling, I believe, yeah. Representative Lesh has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it strikes me the same way what Representative Liebling was saying. I think people have worked on it quite a bit, and I don't think I have the same concerns as Representative Liebling, because having drafted jury instructions, judges craft them, and I guess law clerks craft them, actually, in light of the principles of due process and how their other cases have gone. So I guess I don't see as much of the problem, but maybe Representative Liebling could talk with you guys offline to see if there is any wiggle room there or not.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to talk with Representative Liebling about this. I think, as I mentioned at the outset on this bill, a lot of people have worked very hard and in great detail on this language, and I'm trusting their expertise, but I'm also trying to reflect in presenting this bill that a lot of very difficult issues had to be negotiated to get to the language we're at right now. So I'm more than happy to talk about those concerns, and I'm sure we all want to do the best we can with this, but we've arrived at what I think is some very good, solid language, and we want to move it forward.
Okay. Ms. Sweezy, did you have a comment on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Liebling, it is the nature of a defense anyway that the defendant has to come forward with it on some level. Whenever a defendant brings forth a defense, we as prosecutors don't know what it is they're going to allege as to why they're not guilty. So whenever a defense is presented in a criminal trial, it is the defendant's burden, obviously, to bring something forward. Whether or not they get a jury instruction has to do with the amount of evidence that they produce, and whether the judge decides that they're entitled to it. And what we've simply tried to do here is to put out three situations that kept repeating in our discussions at the outset, all of which we were in agreement would be a defense anyway and would probably result in a not guilty verdict by a jury, but to put them specifically in the statute for a couple of reasons. Not only to provide it at trial, but the way we do business as prosecutors, when we issue charges and we read our statutes, we'll look at that. We'll look at the affirmative defense even before we issue the case. And if there's evidence presented to us at the time of charging that this affirmative defense exists, that will inform our charging decision, rather than sending the law out statewide without saying specifically, these are the three things we meant to address that shouldn't apply here. So that was one of the other goals, was to make sure that at the very beginning that a prosecutor was reading that these were three types of situations that were not meant to result in convictions.
All right. Representative Liebling, any further questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know what, I think I'll leave it at that for now, and maybe we do need to talk about this a little bit more offline. And I guess I would just say that the problem that I have is not that these three things are listed at all. It's just the burden that the way it's structured for them to be brought forward. And I think there are other ways that this can be done, and we can talk about that further later on.
All right. Thank you. Representative Gottwald, do you have another testifier on this bill?
I do, Mr. Chair. I'd like to invite Iris Freeman to the table.
Okay. Representative Allen, did you have a question for the previous testifier? Ms. Sweezy, if you could come back to the chair, we have one more question for you. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sweezy, I'd follow up on question. I don't think you answered the second question that regarding the amendment, on the amendment where, let's see, let me find it here. Oh, it's the penalties. The, where you have the other conduct resulting in 1 year, it's paragraph 3, it's subdivision 3.
Perhaps if you can give us a line reference, yeah, Representative Kelly.
Representative Gottwald, yeah. Thank you. Representative Allen, if you can reference a line.
I thought I saw an amendment where it would be subdivision 2A penalties. We have one. And there's paragraph 1 and then there's paragraph 2. Did you take out the paragraph 3? There was a in previous versions or?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, thank you for the question. We're cross-referencing, I believe, with the original language. And so let me just get to that. Yeah. And you're talking about subdivision 3 under penalties.
Okay. This is deleted. Okay.
Representative Gottwald, I believe on the original bill, House File 1945, lines 2.1, 2.2, would that be correct, Representative Allen?
Okay. All right, thank you.
Gottwald, would you address that issue?
That is correct. We do not have the third item in the penalty section of the DE2 amendment. That is correct.
Representative Allen, any
further
questions?
Yeah, no, that answers my question. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Sweezy, for coming back to the testifiers table. Now, Representative Gottwald, I invite your next testifier forward. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members, I am Iris Freeman, Associate Director of the Center for Elder Justice and Policy at William Mitchell College of Law. My professional training is in social work, and I've worked for 35 years now to protect vulnerable adults from neglect, from abuse, and from financial exploitation. When I began this work in the mid-1970s, Minnesota didn't have so much as a required report of adult abuse to the authorities. Public awareness, prevention measures, investigative methods, and response systems have been built brick by brick in rooms like this. In the last several years, Minnesota has made strides in updating its protections in criminal law, especially those focusing on financial exploitation. Today, we're moving toward adding a critical piece in the criminal code, a higher penalty for intentional neglect that results in pronounced physical harm to the victim. House File 1945, as amended, did not come lightly, as you heard. I would greatly exceed my allotted time this morning describing the years of deliberation and differences that went before. Suffice it to say, this has been a long time coming. The legislation is for victims who are deprived of the most basic food and water, wound care, pain medication. Most tragically, typical situations occur in such isolation that no one can even make a report or call for help, certainly not in time to rescue the victim from devastating injuries. And so that's the point. This is not about human errors, accidents, and the emergencies that always come in pairs when you care for multiple patients. They are the cases at the margins. House File 1945, as amended, clarifies those shared principles and leads us away from being one of the very few states, only five, in the country that does not have a felony level consequence for these horrific cases. There is broad-based support among seniors and disability advocates. The number of letters in your packet testify to that. So thank you very much for making 2012 the year that we will enact a serious, appropriate consequence in the cases that shock our consciences. Thank you, Ms. and I'd be glad to answer
questions
of a social work nature.
All right. Okay. Don't see any questions from our committee. Thank you for your testimony this morning. Representative Gottwald, do you have one more testifier?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Goodnow, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Home Care Association. Additionally, the Home Care Association has worked with other providers, and on behalf of those broader group of providers, we're here to speak in support of House File 1945 as amended. The other provider groups include the Long-Term Care Imperative, ARM, the Minnesota Hospital Association as well. In dealing with this bill, and a lot of times when we talk about felony neglect, we're looking at the issue and focus on the facility aspect of it, but it does cover facilities, nursing homes, hospitals, ICFMRs, or now ICFDDs, but it also applies to group homes and in-home situations as well. And it not only applies to paid caregivers, but family caregivers too, so it has a very broad reach. And with that, we wanted to make sure that the bill was introduced and had the intended consequences. It did not have some unintended consequences that could impact those family caregivers, those paid caregivers, and quite frankly, providers out there who are working in the best interest of the vulnerable adult, but through some happenstance, some bad things do happen. And so with the language and with the compromise that Representative Gottwald has brought us to, we are supportive of the bill, and we're happily so. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Goodnow. Any questions for this testifier? All right. Seeing none, thank you. Representative Gottwald, any further comments?
Mr. Chair and committee members, just to thank you for the opportunity to hear the bill. Again, I think this is a remarkable result of a remarkable process. It's good legislation whose time has come, and I think will, in fact, serve as a model for the rest of the nation, and I hope you can support it. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was the commissioner going to speak on this issue, or is she just here to support? Or?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, I was remiss in not inviting Commissioner Jessen to the table. She graciously agreed to be here to represent the administration's position, and if you've got a moment, I would like invite her up.
Please call her forward. All right. Representative Hillstrom, that's it? Okay. Well, good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. I just wanted to say a few words about this bill. I first want to express great appreciation to Representative Gottwald, as well as to County Attorney Freeman and many others, but particularly to the good representative who I think has brought forward a very good bill. As Commissioner of Human Services, as many of you all know, I wear many hats in this matter. We, the department, provide direct services to over 10,000 vulnerable adults every year. You know, we also pay through our Medicaid system for a lot of the care that's provided here. We also regulate at the department through our licensing division many of the providers that provide this care. And both in my role as commissioner and, I was a former member of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, I've seen a real need for this bill. I support this bill, and while only this morning received the amendment, I must say that, looking at it here, I think this amendment does an excellent job of striking a balance between protecting vulnerable adults, which we so need to do in this state, and avoiding the unintended consequences that Mr. Goodnow and Representative Gottwald referred to. So I just didn't want to take up lots of your time. Happy to answer any questions, but just wanted to let you know of my support for this bill.
All right. Are there any questions for this testifier? All right. Thank you, Commissioner Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Gottwald, have we summed it up already?
Mr. Chair, I think we're through presenting the bill, and again, I would just ask members to support it.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify in favor of or in opposition to House File 1945 as amended? Seeing none, the committee will move to the vote. Representative Grunhagen renews his motion that House File 1945 as amended be moved to pass and sent to the Public Safety Committee. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say nay. Congratulations, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Now we will revert to item two on our calendar for the day with Representative Cornish presenting House File 1938. Good morning, Representative Cornish.
Good morning.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 1938 to be recommended to pass and move to, is it going to my committee or is it going, Chairman?
Yes, it'll go to Public Safety.
Public Safety Committee.
All right. Representative Cornish moves House File 1938. I see no amendments here today. Are we ready to proceed with your testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, House File 1938, what it would explicitly do, if you take a look at it in your packet, in about year 2000, a special division of the Department of Corrections formed the Fugitive Apprehension. I used to call it the task force. I know it's called Fugitive Apprehension Unit.
That's correct, Representative
Cornish. And it's a regular law enforcement agency with all the requirements and statutes. Testifier, Director Gerlicher, will probably give you the specific focus of the Fugitive Apprehension Unit. But when it was formed, for some reason, which Ms. Gerlicher will always, or Director Gerlicher will always also get into, they were left out of the being able to apply a search for a search warrant. Other law enforcement agencies, as you know, and they're listed on this bill, Deputy Sheriff, Police Officer, Conservation Officer, BCA, Division of Alcohol and Gambling, University of Minnesota, Peace Officer, Metropolitan Transit Officer, they can all do that. And it makes real complication for the Fugitive Apprehension Unit in their mission to have to go and draw on somebody else to be able to apply for a search warrant. So under this proposed legislation, we would add them specifically on line 1.20 and 1.21 to the group of other law enforcement agencies that are allowed to apply for search warrant, and we remove the specific limitation in 241.025 subdivision 2 in line 1.11 and through 1.13. And if I could turn it over to my testifier, Director Gerlicher, that'd be great.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Representative Hillstrom has a question before we proceed.
Mr. Chair, just when all the testifiers are done, I just have a question for Representative
Cornish. All right. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Well, good morning. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carrie Gerlicher. I am the Chief Law Enforcement Officer for the Minnesota Department of Corrections Fugitive Apprehension Unit. Mr. Chair and Committee, as Representative Cornish stated, the legislature created the Minnesota Department of Corrections Fugitive Apprehension Unit in the year 2000. At that time, there were some concerns from other law enforcement agencies in the community that the Fugitive Unit would become another task force heavily involved in narcotics investigations, and that could possibly have some bearing on their asset forfeiture availabilities. In order to address the concern at the time, we agreed to waive the search warrant eligibility, as we knew that we had no desire to become a narcotics unit. We, to this date, have and will not ever become a narcotics unit. Our main goal in life has been and will continue to be to arrest Department of Corrections warranted fugitives. Statutory language currently limits the fugitive units as a forfeiture participation as it sits today, and we have no desire to broaden that. In the past 10 years, we've taken less than $15,000 off the street in regards to asset forfeitures, and we've given well over $50,000 to $60,000 back to the law enforcement agencies where the arrests were originally made, as we had stated we would do 10 years ago and as we will continue to do. So that issue is no longer a concern to law enforcement. We've proven our desire to stay on our task. New technology over the last several years, particularly with computers and cell phones, has greatly increased our need for search warrant authority. We arrest over 400 convicted felons every year, and oftentimes those apprehensions are based solely on a search warrant application that's been applied on a cell phone so that we can track GPS-wise where that fugitive is who's using the phone. We also currently request, in the past 5 years, we've had to request search warrants be drawn up by 13 law enforcement agencies. Oftentimes, we use the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office to draw up our search warrants and the U.S. Marshals. I have two sworn officers currently assigned to the U.S. Marshals Task Force, and we have a Ramsey County deputy assigned to my unit working, and so we've been able to use them to execute or to draw search warrants for us, but quite frankly, it really is our responsibility. There have been times when we have been in Hennepin County or Ramsey County when we have had the desire for a search warrant to go into a home of someone who was not the main address of one of our fugitives, and we've had to call an investigator out to the street who has no knowledge of the case we're working on, fill them in on what we've done so that they can take time out of their duties and a case they're currently investigating to write a search warrant. People have been willing to do it. They've been very gracious, but quite frankly, it's time-consuming for them, and it's our responsibility to author our own search warrants. So I have spoken to the Sheriff's Association. I have spoken at length to the Chiefs Association. I sit on their board as the treasurer, and both of those associations have agreed that giving the Department of Corrections Fugitive Unit the opportunity to write our own search warrants is justified.
All right.
And if, Mr. Chair, if I might add to that,
Representative Cornish.
It does not reduce their need to meet the same requirements for a search warrant, probable cause and everything else. They have to abide by the same rules. It's just allowing them to get into the group that can draw their own.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cornish. Questions from the committee? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, I don't have an issue with whether or not they should be able to draft a search warrant. I actually just want to talk about how that process actually would work. Some communities or counties require that in order for law enforcement to get a search warrant to be presented, that the county attorney in that area has to review it first and then it's submitted to the court. Would they have to follow whatever that local jurisdiction policy or procedure is? And then once they've gotten the search warrant, do they have to notify that local entity that they are coming into that jurisdiction to execute that search warrant?
And I let the fire answer that.
Representative Cornish, Ms. Gerlicher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. That is correct. We would follow whatever guidelines, whatever county we currently are in holds. We do that anyway. And already there is language in the fugitive apprehension statutory language that requires us, excuse me, to notify the law enforcement agency anytime we're in their jurisdiction doing work. And this would be involved in that as well. We currently do that today. So if I go into the city of Rochester, and make an apprehension, I have to contact Rochester Police Department before we even knock on the door. If we go into Albert Lea, Minnesota, and do a knock and talk to a girlfriend's house, we're obligated to notify that law enforcement agency that we're in their community doing work. This would just be additional work, and we would continue to follow the rules we've done for the past 10 years.
Great. Any follow-up, Representative Hillstrom? Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gerlicher, you might already said this, but why, again, was the fugitive apprehension unit, why were they specifically limited originally? What was the reason for that, as far as you know?
Ms. Gerlicher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, when the fugitive apprehension unit was originally started, there were some concerns in law enforcement on the addition of a new law enforcement unit. There were concerns that this law enforcement unit would go into communities, apprehend our fugitives, and there was some suspicion that a majority of, or many of our fugitives would probably be involved in illegal narcotic sales. And so that if we went into those jurisdictions and found large quantities of narcotics and cash, we would take those cash proceeds and the narcotics, push the narcotics case forward, and then not allow the community in which that arrest happened to actually participate in those asset forfeitures. That really was the big concern. We have no desire to do that. We had no desire to do that in the past. So what happens today, and it's also written in statutory language, if we come upon a fugitive in a home, in a business that is in custody of narcotics, weapons, cash, whatever, that case is referred to the jurisdiction in which the arrest is made. We don't touch any of that. The only time that we have taken cash off the street is when we've arrested a fugitive in the street and they've had narcotics in one pocket and $2,000 in the other. And quite frankly, there are times when we've come upon those situations when the arrest was assisted by another municipal law enforcement agency. We've just given them everything. We really don't have the desire to get involved in those types of cases.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps.
All right. And then Representative Liebling has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I have two, basically, a question and then a comment. The question is just, has the defense bar been notified about this? Do they have any objection to it, as far as you know, or public defenders?
Right, Ms. Gerlicher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I have not personally spoken to them, and to the best of my knowledge, they have no concern. I mean, the reality is we are putting in place a step that a local law enforcement jurisdiction would do anyway. It's not going to add the number of search warrants. It's not going to decrease the number of search warrants. It's just giving authority to the rightful investigator to apply for one.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, while you were responding, I thought of another kind of concern about this, and I'll just lay it out there, and that is that if your agency is doing the search warrant, you may end up coming to testify, maybe that you wouldn't have done before, showing up in court to testify in cases. I don't know if maybe you'll want to address that. But the comment I wanted to make has to do with this forfeiture issue about why this was put in 10 years ago. And I want to flag this for the committee members, that this has to do with forfeiture. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this whole, what you said, that they were, that the agencies, the police agencies, were concerned that your agency was going to participate in forfeiture. That has to do with the fact that the agency that grabs the property from the wrongdoer, or sometimes they're not really a wrongdoer, but the agency that grabs the property gets to keep much of the asset. So the police agencies, and in this it's less true now because it was adjusted. They get less of the money now, but they still get a good chunk of the money. But 10 years ago, they were getting, like, I don't know if it was 80% or more of the what they would take. So what you're hearing here is that there was a little turf war about who got to keep the money from forfeitures. And I just want to flag that for you, because this is part of the whole problem with forfeitures in the state, not that it has anything really to do with this bill today. Because I understand this isn't a concern, and I get that. I'm glad that's not an issue here. But what you're hearing is that when this all happened in 2000, police departments didn't want to lose any of the cash they were going to get from the forfeitures. So that was why this was put in place. So just wanted to make that comment, and maybe you want to comment about the issue of, you know, putting a burden on your agency to show up in court and testify on these things.
Ms. Gerlicher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. I'm not concerned about that extra burden. We testify in hearings for other reasons anyway. There are times when we arrest and charge people with aiding and abetting a fugitive. We have to testify in those hearings. There are times when we charge sex offenders with failure to register as a sex offender. We testify in those hearings. There may be times when we arrest a fugitive, some sex offender who maybe has a past history of child abuse, and when we arrest them, they are in custody of children, and so there's possible that new charges or a neglect case may be added. We testify in those hearings anyway. This would not concern me as an additional burden. We follow through on those processes anyway, as we should.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair,
Representative Cornish.
Just for some comfortability, these are professional peace officers with full peace officer authority are usually, I think, seasoned veterans. In fact, a number of years of experience on and come probably from other units, and it's a pretty sought-after position by other law enforcement to get on this unit. And further, the list that you see of the people who are on from line 1.16 down to 1.21, if my memory, if I recollect properly, that list was a lot shorter. Over the years, they've been added on, and I think conservation officers a number of years ago were added on there. And it, Director Gerlich talked about was just one of the things, the forfeiture, I think that was a small one. It usually ends up to be a sheriff deal, where sheriffs are really concerned about somebody coming into their jurisdiction. And the sheriff's director, Jim Frank, was in my office the other day, and he did say that he did support this now, and it's a pretty professional unit that they trust to be operating within their jurisdiction. So.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cornish. Do we have anyone else with questions or anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 1938? Seeing none, Representative Cornish, would you like to renew your motion? Representative Smith, excuse me.
I did have a question for the author. It's my understanding, Representative Cornish, that this bill, 1938, is an initiative brought to you from the Department of Corrections. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Representative Cornish.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, I believe so.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the
Representative Smith,
Commissioner of the Department of Corrections is appointed by the Governor, Governor Dayton, so then I would conclude that this is an initiative and a bill that the Governor also wants. Is that correct?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, I believe that is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Cornish?
To renew my motion, House File 938 be recommended to pass and move to the Public Safety Committee.
Okay, the motion is before us. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say nay.
Thank you.
The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Cornish. Okay. That concludes our business before the committee this morning. Our next committee meeting will be February 21st, 2012. At that time, we're going to take up two bills that were previously passed by this committee and sent to the floor, House File 795 and House File 1418. We'll take those up Tuesday morning, and then we will begin discussion in family law, taking up House Files 292 and House File 322. So with no further business before this committee, we are... Pardon? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it your intention to vote on those two family law bills, or is it your intention to just start the discussion?
We will start the discussion on them.
Okay, and then they'll be laid over.
We will determine that at a future point. All right. We are adjourned.